Strangers did not quite know how to take him. They were confused. They had expected a devout, learned, serious person. How could he be so human and amusing? But he was, and those traits endeared him to the few fortunate enough to meet him. S.A. Copyright answers, never. He had no time at all for spiritualism. He never ever held any kind of meetings or gatherings or prayer sessions, never meditated in company. He believed strongly in personal growth, never in groups. He had no need of the usual kind of gatherings that are particularly popular in North America and often border on cultism. His firm refusal to join with groups angered some who would have liked him as their figurehead, and caused him to be the butt of their hostility, resulting in criticism which was as ungrounded as it was ignorant. But, as always, he maintained his position, never wavering from what he believed to be right. A short time after AO III IE was published, we uprooted ourselves and made the first of many moves. We took an apartment in Dublin, and from there a house in a small place on the Irish coast, not too far from Dublin, called Howth. Those familiar with Dr. Anpa TMS books already know something about our life there and about the friends he made among the local people in that fishing village. Ben Edir was a small stone-built house overlooking the sea, seemingly hanging on the cliff face. Quite unpretentious, not ugly yet not particularly pretty. The entrance to the house was at one end, not in the middle as is more usual, and one entered directly from the road. No driveway or path, just a few steps up from the road to the front door. Once inside, you realized you were on the upper floor of the house with a hall, or corridor, stretching straight ahead the length of the house. There were two rooms, or perhaps three, on the side of the corridor facing the road, and on the side facing the sea there was one smallish room where a telescope was permanently set up and binoculars and photographic equipment were housed. Beyond that room there was another large room, the principal room of the house, with a bay window jutting out over the open sea commanding a magnificent view, an immense expanse of sea and sky, and in the foreground a large rock, almost an island, named Island TMSI. It was reasonably close, this rock. One could row out there and land quite easily in a matter of 10 minutes or so, and we often did. This room, naturally enough, was Chima TMS room. His bed was placed in the bay window and the position was ideal for him. That the windows did not fit and that the wind howled through the ill-fitting panes during stormy weather was no big problem. He was tough as nails when it came to cold or stormy weather of any kind. He simply braved it naturally, seemingly with no need of extra clothing. It was as if he did not feel cold, had no awareness of it. I can see him quite clearly in my mind at TMSI sitting up in bed in thin cotton pajamas enjoying a storm, watching the flashes of lightning as the wind howled and the waves roared, broke and retracted on the shingle below, while Art Mab and I were wrapped up in woolen sweaters, thick socks and even so shivering. On this coast there were a variety of weather conditions ranging from dense, cloying fog to lightning, storms and gale-force winds, onto calm seas and idyllic skies. It was ever-changing, never dull. I would go so far as to say he loved the place. After the turmoil of life in a huge metropolis and the upheavals and pettiness he had encountered, here in contrast we were so closely aligned to nature and to natural forces where there was no subterfuge, no misunderstanding, nothing false. It was as light after dark, calm after the storm. He experienced a sense of peace and harmony in Howth, perched over the sea in that little house, not to be found again in all the time I knew him. The lower floor was reached by a staircase at the far end of the corridor. The staircase turned and halfway down, on the turning, there was a bathroom which had undoubtedly been added after the original house was built. This lower floor had three small rooms, semi-basement rooms really as they were below the level of the road and actually very damp. My bedroom was at the staircase end at the side of the house, and it was necessary to keep a fire burning in the grate during the winter to combat the damp visibly creeping up the walls. I loved the fire. I loved to go to sleep watching the glow and the patterns on the ceiling from the occasional leaping flame. It was civilized, it evoked my childhood, and it comforted and warmed the heart as well as the body. On the lower floor facing the sea there was a very large kitchen with a flagged floor and big window giving the impression of almost being outside. Clearly this kitchen was intended for eating as well as for cooking because there was space for a good sized table to seat easily up to 8 people around it. The original cooking arrangements were still in place, a great fireplace and 2 ovens, a hook over the fire for a pot to simmer, but there was also a more modern and quite ugly gas stove which we used for practicality. A rough garden path running under the window led down to the pebbly beach below where we kept a small dingy moored up. The house was unremarkable except for its almost unique position, and few people would have found it convenient. So far as furnishing and embellishments went, we had the minimum, which was in keeping with the way the Rampers lived. What we did have was simple and practical. This was a period of financial stability, but it changed nothing in their way of life except that the worry of poverty was eradicated. It was possible to buy equipment needed for his work, and whenever a needy individual crossed his path, Chen was able to help in a material sense. Of the handful of people with whom we became friendly, the one I think of with greatest affection was the local policeman, or guardia. I had my typewriter set up under the window in my room, the window at the side of the house, and from there I could see anyone who happened to stop and look over the stone wall which protected the house and surroundings. I hesitate to use the word a gardener because it was wild, rough ground, from the road. Once or twice I had noticed the guardia standing there beside the wall, and assumed he was on his daily beat and was taking a pause to look out over the sea. On the third occasion I paid more attention to him. His gaze was not directed at the sea at all. He seemed to be looking at something under my window, or very near, with intense interest. I left my typing and went upstairs. "Ao Chen, the guardia is standing by the wall looking at something under my window. Do you think I should go and see what it is?" I asked. He was reading, but put down his book and swung his legs off the bed. "Aoyatmll go, eh?" he said, slipping his feet into his shoes and shrugging on his black jacket. "Ao, you never know with policemen, even Irish ones." That was the start of our friendship with Pat. What he has been eyeing with such interest was an old stone sink half buried under rubble and obviously thrown out and forgotten. He dearly wanted that sink. I forget now exactly what he wanted it for, but he wanted it. It was perfect for his needs - but dare he ask for it? Well, he did, and of course he got it, and his gratitude knew no bounds, even though by rights it belonged not to us but to our landlord. Bate was tall, a well-built fellow, good for the job partly because he towered above the rest of the community. At the same time, he was conscientious to a fault, and remained slightly aloof from others, as his position demanded. He had assumed a facial expression suitable for the job, tough and somewhat fierce, but as we, and possibly everyone else, knew, it was more than a slight front, and in fact hid a soft-hearted, modest, and genuine man. He would call at the house frequently and come in to chat with Chen. It took no great stretch of the imagination to see it as being in the line of duty. These chats, and so it was because a wide range of subjects was covered in their conversations, which could only have opened his eyes and been of assistance in assessing and uncovering petty crime. The two of them together would have presented a serious deterrent to any would-be wrongdoer, although as it happened there was scarcely any crime in that village and the outlying district, the greater part of Pater TMS work being to assist people in difficulties, straighten out arguments, pick up the drunkards fallen in the ditch and get them home before worse befell them. In his youth he had fought with the Irish against the English and loved to tell us about how they, the handful of gallant Irishmen, held the post office in Dublin against overwhelming odds, the odds being the beastly English, although that was never quite put into words. The fact that Rat Mab and I were the enemy seemingly never crossed his mind. The Irish, as a nation, are born tactful, have kissed the Blarney Stone in their thousands, but he seemed genuine in that he bore not the slightest grudge and was never anything but courteous and friendly to both of us. As was common in Ireland, he referred to Chen as himself and Rat Mab as herself. We were, Of course, he lies to him as to almost everyone in the village, and it is probable that he confessed faithfully each week to the priest behind the grill that his major transgression was his association with us. Presumably he was always forgiven, for he became the best of friends, a recipient of the unique care and attention that raised him from the daily round, that gave him a glow, and that was a part of Lobsang Ranpati's grace bestowed on so many who came within his orbit. Then there was Edgar. Edgar was the boatman, or one of them. He was wiry, worn and wrinkled, dried out by wind and sun, aged well beyond his years and with a habit of constantly hitching up his shabby trousers which reeked of fish and salt water. He shared the boat with his brother who was not nearly so colourful, in fact I cannot even remember his name. They took people out in their boat during the summer, and if the 35 had been anyone around in the winter they would, I am sure, have been available for trips all year round. It was a simple wooden boat with an outboard motor which usually started at the first try but sometimes didn't at TMT, and seated perhaps 6, or maybe 8 people at most. In the summer months you could see it chugging around the harbour and up the coast a short distance with 1 or 2 brave or foolhardy tourists aboard. During the winter the brothers did precious little. We would see the pair of them sitting around with the boat pulled up beside them while they mended fishing nets and gossiped with anyone and everyone who would listen. Very often we hired their boat complete with Edgar to take us out for a few hours, as long as we could, but it was only a drop in the ocean of poverty. Suspect, to judge from the excessive touching of his greasy and ancient cap, that Chen slipped many extra notes into that calloused, ever hopeful and needy hand whenever we happened to see him. Edgar was the father of a horde of children, but the eldest almost certainly did not owe his paternity to Edgar, and it cannot be considered libelous to say that this child TM's father had been a Catholic brother who had blessed a poor little Mrs. Edgar with his progeny. It was considered an honor, and the man who married her to make of her an honest woman subsequent to the pregnancy must, one can only suppose and hope, also have been blessed, somewhat similar to doing a good turn to the Lord. Poor old Edgar. The only blessing he would be likely to receive. Clearly, there were no feminists around in Howth or anywhere else within the Irish working class at that time. The family that ensued from the marriage was, of course, desperately poor, and to feed and care for all the children who arrived in rapid succession one after the other must have been a most horrible and gruesome nightmare. Once I was dispatched to the home of Edgar TM's family. The details of the visit are not important, nor the reasons why I went, which in any case escape my mind, but what I do remember with startling and awful clarity was the state in which they lived. The cottage was no more than a shack. There was a foul and acrid smell of wet nappies pervading everything, there were babies and children in various stages and ages running around half naked among a few scrawny hens scratching away in the dirt outside, with an evil-looking one-eyed cat crouched up in a rotting tree watching over the lot of them. The oldest child, also ironically named Edgar, was standing apart from all of this, quiet and serious-looking. Even his clothes and face seemed cleaner than the rest of them. The mother, her face lined as that of a woman twice her age, her hair long and uncombed with streaks of premature grey, her whole demeanour on seeing me to please, smiled a pathetic smile revealing a lack of teeth and intended to disguise the fact that she was at the very end of her tether. I felt physically sick that this poor woman lived this life seeing it as her lot, conned into the belief that God wanted it this way. That somehow her life should be a huge punishment, a penance for some unknown sin, and too feared and to raise any objection. I remember distinctly leaving the cottage with a feeling of weight and sadness hard to explain. Chen was able to assist the family a little financially, but there could never be enough. He did rescue little Edgar for a few years at least so the child could attended the Christian Brothers school which, after all, was his birthright. While often I felt great frustration that their faith bound them so tightly, shackled them, Chen never I think saw it in the same way. He respected that it was their faith, he realized it was an essential part of their existence, not to be questioned or destroyed by others. It saddened him to see suffering, but he knew it as part of the human condition. to take away their faith, however cruel that faith may seem, however senseless to others, would be to destroy them utterly. He was never known to make any attempt to change a persona TMS basic belief. Apart from the material help he gave them, he treated Edgar the boatman with a respect that it is doubtful few if any had ever shown him. Edgar was an uneducated working man, not especially hard-working either, because a lot of the time there simply was no work, but Chen talked to him as an equal. He talked about boats and the sea, about sailing and the weather, about the tourists, about a host of things Edgar understood and could relate to. His life on the sea had taught him things he would never have learnt in the schoolroom. The elements are cruel but thorough teachers, and with Chen he had a chance to air his knowledge. In a short time he seemed to grow in stature, he seemed to stand straighter and look one in the eye. But like the woman who lived across from the rampers in the rooming house in London, there was little one could do or should do to ease their lives. Both had their chosen paths. One could only show acknowledgement as well as kindness, and hope that at some time they would remember it and not feel completely alone and forsaken by their God, that God in whom they had blind faith no matter what blows he dealt them. Of the others in the town, one remembers the taxi driver and the couple who lived further up Ball's Garden Road, off the road a little, away from the sea, in a modern house along with a number of other such houses. What was remarkable about this couple was the fact that Chen befriended them at all, but he did, especially Vera, who became quite a good friend of Rat Mab. In fact, he made it possible for her and her daughter to visit us later on in Canada, which I think was the trip of a lifetime for them. Paddy, the husband, was a jolly, easygoing type of man, and it was not unusual to see him weaving his way up Ball's Garden Road in a drunken haze, probably just off the Dublin bus whose terminus was at the bottom of the road beside the kiosk. On such occasions I kept away, either giving him a very wide berth or simply returning to the house until he had made his merry way past, which sometimes took a remarkably long time. Chen was very middle of the way and tolerant in his views on life. But alcohol was one thing he detested. He saw it as driving out the psyche, which left the drunkard open to possession by lower astral entities, and even if the possession is temporary, it still is harmful. That is why his tolerance with Paddy always surprised me. Obviously, he knew Paddy to be no teetotaler. It didn't TMT take great brain power to deduct that, but it somehow was not mentioned at home. As Rat Mab was friendly with Vera, maybe it was prudent to say nothing. Perhaps we skirted round the subject, or rather, perhaps I did. The local taxi driver was another like Edgar, another who must have felt he had won the jackpot when the rampers came to town. He was a slow type, solid, not very talkative. If you went to his house in the main street, it was always mealtime, a mealtime that spanned the whole day and left him heavy set and somewhat sluggish. It had never been his way to ask or expect much from life. He took it as it came and was thankful for a hard-working wife who kept the place clean and tidy and looked after the accounts. What troubled him most was the fact that the taxi, his livelihood, obviously was going to crack up and expire before he did, and what then? As it was, there was barely enough to keep the old girl running, and he dreaded a breakdown on the road somewhere. He was a bit of a mechanic, had to be when cars were your business, but he was no expert, and anything fancy like a new engine was out of the question for him to deal with, and far too costly for anyone else. He just trusted in the Lord and said his prayers twice daily, and even if he was not the most faithful of church attendants, he had great confidence his prayers would be heard. We used the taxi quite a lot, mainly for going to Dublin but also for trips around the countryside and along the coast. We must have been the best of customers. Not only did we cover a good mileage, there was also a large tip as well as the cost of the fare at the end of each trip. 39 After living in house for a while, we bought a Heinkel, a three-wheeled car, or a Ikerateau if there is such a word, a tiny vehicle which was adequate for most things, but we never forgot the taxi driver. Nothing was said to me at home, but one day I met him in the town driving a spanking new car and looking puffed up with pride as well as food. "Aoy, Ed, what a beautiful car!" I exclaimed, as he slowed down on seeing me. "AOR, it is indeed, miss. The good doctor himself knows a good one when he sees it. When I got home and asked about the car, I discovered that yes, it had been given to him by Chen. Eh, poor fellow, he was worried sick he at TMD breakdown one day in the middle of nowhere, maybe with a woman in the back about to give birth or worse. Had to lift the worry. As simple as that. It was just a car after all. Money in itself meant very little to Chen, but he valued it as a means to an end. It was the brick of the so-called civilized world without which nothing could be built. He left Trat Mab to actually handle the money, and she was by nature secretive and cautious. It was not necessarily that she did not trust one personally, it was hard for her to trust anyone. At that time when we were living in Ireland there must have been money from AO the Third Eye, and heavy taxes too, but it was a subject we seldom discussed as a family. The book was successful, that I knew, but its success was valuable, to me at any rate, not so much for the money as for the fact that he had made a success after a hard, uphill struggle to find a way of making a living. He was always generous with money, giving excessive tips and help to people he saw as needy, even when later he had very little, and at that time he never, for instance, went into Dublin without bringing back gifts, things to please like boxes of chocolates, plants, books. On the other side of the coin he disliked accepting anything from anyone, in fact for a time it became quite a bone of contention with me. I saw it as unfeeling and ungracious, yet how could it be? He was grace personified. Perhaps it was simply that he knew himself to be different, to have no ties to earth, and he had no wish to incur debts of any sort. His attitude around this was not altogether a good thing in that it was misunderstood not only by myself but by others who felt a need to express their appreciation of him, and how else to do it than by some gift they felt would please? When they received a rebuff, it left a feeling of coldness and resentment. He did accept gifts of money because this was used to buy research materials, things needed for his work, and he regarded his work solely as of benefit to the world and of no benefit or gain to him personally. The gift of money was intended for a job he had undertaken. At the same time, if he was able to repay the donor in some way, then he did. Sometimes one had to wonder if he regretted the commitment he had made, the work he was to do, although he was never heard to express such an idea himself. Later, in view of the persecution he received from those who would most benefit from his work, it seemed excessively hard and unfair. And he did accept help on a daily basis around things he could easily have done himself had he not been so mindful of the feelings of others. To work with he was the most charming, endearing guide and companion imaginable. He had the amazing gift of making you feel worthwhile, able and competent, even if you were really not that wonderful, and certainly not nearly as good or as quick as he was himself at doing things. He loved to teach you how to do a thing, always with patience and humor, and the secret was that he truly did enjoy it. He was able to bring out the best in a person even if they appeared to have very little to bring out. He was like a gardener tending plants, aware of the individual needs and able to provide them because he loved to see life flourish. Living within his orbit was relaxed, harmonious while at there. Same time active and busy, always on to the next thing and carrying you along with him. I cannot think of any more privileged position to be in, and when compared to the horrors of the modern business and professional world it was paradise. He was not only thoughtful and generous to the underprivileged. A persona TMS station in life was unimportant to him, and it does often happen that the higher the position of a person the greater the vicissitudes and lesser the possibility of external assistance, so the rich and powerful were seen by him as being just as needy as the poor in certain circumstances. Chen had a refreshing disregard when it came to social mores and tenets. He would tell us that he had no training in the proper way to behave in the things one did and did not do, and although the fact that he had no training was perfectly true, he actually knew very well what society expected of him but saw it as superficial and ridiculous, often to the exasperation of others. He did what he considered appropriate and right according to his own belief, No matter who he was dealing with, he would approach a well-to-do person in exactly the same way he would a laborer, a politician in the same way as a clerk. They all had problems and difficulties, even if those problems varied according to the persona TMS position which, in any case, to him was temporary and applicable to this life only. If he saw a way to help, or was asked, he did. It comes down, really when one analyzes it, to a complete and utter lack of snobbery which in general is unusual, even among those who loudly proclaim their democratic ideology and freedom from snobbery but then are found to have their own form of it, just the same as anyone else. Before we leave Houth entirely, there is one other person I have to include although I never actually spoke to her. Eventually she, too, was to experience Chinna TMS grace even. Though it was rudely cut off when we had to leave the country for a different life far away over the sea. I often took the bus into Dublin. The bus was convenient and allowed more time for doing whatever one had to do in town, so more preferable for me than engaging the taxi and being obliged to keep it waiting. The bus left from the bottom of Ballsgarden Road, just a 5-minute walk from Ben Adair, down the hill, round the corner and the Ewer. It left fairly frequently, was mostly on time, and the ride itself was quite pleasant, taking, I suppose, about half an hour each way. It was a double-decker, and I made a habit of sitting on the upper deck where the view was better and the people fewer. It just so happened that regularly when I decided to go into Dublin or had to go for errands such as taking films to develop, collecting the finished prints, buying books or magazines that we were unable to get in Howth, by some curious coincidence a certain female would be taking the same bus, and invariably, as if driven by some secret hidden force, she made her way to the seat directly ahead of me. It was a coincidence that did not particularly please me because this lady was possessed of a very distinctive body odor which floated back, carried on the sea air coming through the open windows, which unremittingly assailed my suffering nostrils. Farmyards, wet dogs, garden manure, none of these things bother me greatly, but the smell of unwashed human bodies I find quite appallingly dreadful and nauseous. Not only that, worse, her neck was filthy, ingrained with black filth, a neck that had not seen soap for perhaps years. It seemed horribly fascinating, almost unbelievable in fact, that anyone could really and truly have such a dirty neck. My eyes were drawn to and fixed on this amazing sight as though to a flashing beacon. Why did I not move my seat, you may well ask? The answer is simple. She was quite obviously someone who had seen better days, and my personal misfortune was, unlike Chen, to have been coached in the social arts of what one did and did not do. So I stayed put. Her clothes were, or had been, quite wonderful. She even sported one or two hats, gloves, and a handbag. In winter she wore Harris tweeds, baggy, worn out but once sturdy and practical tweeds. In summer she wore Liberty prints, years out of date, torn in places with the hems drooping down where they had no right to droop, but Liberty prints nonetheless of astonishing and beautiful colors and designs. If I had moved my seat she could have noticed and been offended. It was necessary to put up with the appalling smell, with the dirty neck, rather than offend a lady in distressed circumstances. After all, although heaven forbid, it could be oneself someday, one never knew. There was, of course, always the possibility that she had been a lady Sir T.M. made wearing cast-offs, but I rejected that idea almost as soon as it crossed my mind. She had a strange manner of walking, almost clumsy, throwing one foot inwards as she went, long-legged, a typical example of overbreeding, and in spite of everything, she had a certain bearing unlike and superior to others. No, there could be no doubt about it, she came from aristocratic stock but somewhere along the line she had gone wrong. As I sat there uneasily longing for the bus to reach Dublin, I often wondered where she had come from, where she lived in the village, what was her history. I contemplated asking someone, but as I framed the question in my mind, "Ayo, do you happen to know where the lady who smells lives?" I decided on the impossibility of it. It just would not do. I would have to quell my curiosity, there was nothing else for it. Then as luck would have it, one day on the return journey she was on the bus going home, already seated,